Shreya Bhagavati Shrimatyam Bhagavati Bhagavati Tamashoke Bhakti Bhagavati Naishtiki. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, 30th chapter, 14th verse. Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Nidade Sadhana Vita.
Nidade Sadhana Vita.
Nidade Sadayan Vita.
Nidade Sadayan Vita.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Nidade Sadayan Vita.
Nidade Sadayan Vita.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Somak Piyusha Varshinim.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Nidathe So Dayan Vida.
Nidathe So Dayan Vida.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Shukshamaya Mukhe Raja.
Soma Piyusha Varshinim.
Soma Piyusha Varshinim.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Deshinim Rodamanaya.
Nidathe Sodayan Vita.
Nidathe Sodayan Vita.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Shukshamaya
Mukhe Raja.
Soma
Piyusha Varshinim.
Deshinim
Rodamanaya. Nidathe Sadayan Vita.
Word for word. Shoot. By hunger. Shamayaha.
Shamayaha.
When she was distressed.
When she was distressed.
Okay.
Within the mouth.
Raja.
Raja.
The king.
Somaha.
Somaha. The moon.
Piyusha.
Piyusha. Necessary. Nectar.
Nectar.
Varshinim.
Varshinim.
Pouring.
Pouring.
Deshinim.
Deshinim.
Forefinger. Rodamanaya.
Rodamanaya.
While she was crying.
While she was crying.
Nidade.
Nidade.
Placed.
Placed.
Saha.
Saha.
He.
He.
Daya Anvitaha.
Daya Anvitaha.
Being compassionate.
Being compassionate.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter the child, who was left to the care of the trees, began to cry in hunger. At that time, the king of the forest, namely the king of the moon planet, out of compassion, placed his finger, which poured forth nectar, within the child's mouth. Thus the child was raised by the mercy of the king of the moon. Thereafter the child, repeat, thereafter the child.
Thereafter the child.
Who was left to the care of the trees.
Who was left to the care of the trees.
Began to cry in hunger.
Began to cry in hunger.
At that time,
the king of the forest,
namely the king of the moon planet,
namely the king of the moon planet,
out of compassion, placed his finger,
which poured forth nectar,
within the child's mouth, Thus the child was raised,
by the mercy,
of the king of the moon,
of the king of the moon.
purport by Srila Prabhupada. Although the Apsara left her child to the care of the trees could not take care of the child properly. Therefore, the trees handed the child over to the king of the moon. Thus Chandra, king of the moon, put his finger within the mouth of the child to satisfy her hunger. So this verse reminded me of something that we sing every day. We sing a verse from the Brahma Samhita, Anganiya Sakalen. Part of the meaning of this is that Krishna's senses can perform the functions of all other senses. In other words, Krishna can see with his hands and fingers. Krishna can taste with his legs and so on and so forth. So there's working senses and knowledge acquiring senses. This made me think that the higher order beings of the universe have these kind of powers too. Sometimes we hear about Yamaraj being able to assess the particular circumstances of each individual. Yamaraj would know their past karma. He figures out how each living entity all over the universe has to be either rewarded or punished. In one lecture, Prabhupada was saying how a particular judge was hearing a case, and the two lawyers, advocates, were arguing which was right, which was wrong. And the justice, or the judge, started to doze off, started to fall asleep. And the assistant to the judge said, "Your Honor, Your Worship, whatever they call them, you're starting to fall asleep." And he kind of woke up and said, "It's all right, I've already made my judgment." So he was listening, but then after a while, he already made a judgment. And the two lawyers were arguing and arguing, but because the judge had some superior knowledge about the case in point, he had already made up his mind. It so happens that some people are endowed with certain levels of intelligence when we're able to ascertain who is correct in very difficult cases very easily. We were reading a judgment by the Karnataka High Court the other day, 81-page judgment. It was a case, an appeal case. It was quite detailed. It was almost difficult to remember who were the plaintiffs and who were the defendants. It was a very long judgment and a very difficult thing to do, but these justices were able to determine who was right and who was wrong in a very complicated case. They were able to do it very easily. I think there is a part of this chapter which talked about, there's a very famous verse or purport, or series of verses where the Prachetas are said to be very much admired by the Lord because of their friendly relationships. And obviously this was something that Krishna values very highly. There was a letter that Prabhupada once wrote to a devotee named Atreya Rishi. It's kind of a famous letter. I think it was written in about 1972 or 73. I think it was 1972. And what had happened is this particular devotee wrote a letter to Prabhupada, kind of a whingy type of letter, sort of complaining about how devotees were sometimes impersonal in their dealings with one another. Prabhupada wrote back to this devotee, and he said that actually, that even in the company of devotees, even in the society of devotees, sometimes there's differences of opinion. Sometimes they result in arguments. He went on to say that this is actually a necessary thing because everybody is an individual, just like every snowflake is supposed to be individual, every leaf's imprint is supposed to be individual, every voice print is supposed to be individual. This is something which supports the individuality of the soul. And I think this is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita too. There's a verse that says that that we're all you and all these kings, Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, are all Natpe Bahu Natutasam Nimajanam Chaiva Navisyava Sarve Vayamatakparam. We've all existed from time immemorial. So if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is emphasizing the fact that every one, every human being is individual, has an individual personality, an individual existence, and an individual set of beliefs. So Prabhupada answered this devotee by saying that everyone is an individual, and therefore this is personalism. It's not impersonalism. Real impersonalism, he went on to say, and not these words, but the idea of it was that is something that we find in the material world. People deal, and we have experience of this, people deal with each other in a very kind of impersonal way. Sometimes people in corporations refer to the corporation as they instead of we, and they talk to their so-called customers or their beloved, valued sort of quote-unquote customers as just things, objects, instead of being people, instead of being persons. So Prabhupada explained in some detail how the real impersonalism is something you experience outside of the Krishna consciousness world, but not inside of it. And the fact that there may be disagreements was something that this devotee wrote to Prabhupada was very unpleasant to him, that he found that his devotees would sometimes disagree with and argue with one another. But he went on to say that this is actually proof that we're individuals. This is proof that we're personal, that we're persons. And that the real impersonalism, he went on to say, is something you experience in the so-called real world, real quote unquote world at large. So this is a very famous letter. I can't quote from it precisely, but this is the idea that it was kind of famous because here was someone who was a devotee, who was initiated by Prabhupada, who was complaining that there was an impersonal element within the ISKCON society. He also complained that there was sometimes argumentation and differences of opinion, and he thought that everything should be just perfect. And this is a very accomplished person, a person who had risen fairly high in the material world. He was an accountant, worked for a big accounting firm, one of the big top five so-called accounting firms in the world. And he had this complaint, and Prabhupada wrote in a very precise way how it was wrong to think of the Krishna consciousness movement as a movement of impersonal beings. They were actually very personal. They dealt with each other in a very personal way. So that was a very important letter. And when Krishna appeared to the Prachetas, one of the things he said when he first met them is he said he was very pleased by their camaraderie, by their very friendly relationships with one another. He was very pleased with that. I think in another, it was either in a walk or a letter, somewhere I heard or read that Prabhupada had said that if there are differences of opinion, that we should discuss these things in a very thoroughly, in a threadbare manner, until we reach a deeper understanding, something like that. Sometimes devotees also complain. I'm getting off the verse topic a little bit here, but it's a very esoteric kind of verse, and I don't know too much about the moon god and his qualities. Prabhupada said that sometimes people complain that the things are supposed to get easier when they're in Krishna consciousness, and they're supposed to be freed from responsibilities. But the complaint is that they sometimes have a lot more responsibilities when they become devotees. They're responsible to their family, they're responsible to their past acharyas, they're responsible to their parents. There's one passage in the Bhagavatam where Yudhisthira is very upset. He's complaining that all this big Kurukshetra war was fought so that he could attain the throne, that he could become the king over Duryodhana and his party. And he was lamenting that so many people died just for me to sit on the throne, for me to sit on the seat. Thousands and millions of people died, not only people, but animals, horses, elephants, and various others. So this was his complaint. And one of the things he said in his complaint was that it's in a way it's kind of silly for me to complain, because these were not these bodies. The bodies belong to, in a sense, they belong, they're owned by our parents and when we're alive. In another sense, the bodies are owned by our employers, just like sometimes people look upon slaves as objects that they can own. And then in death, the body can be said to be owned by the worms that eat the body if it's buried, or some people feed the body, dead bodies, to birds in parts of India, so or dogs eat dead bodies. I think I heard once Prabhupada say that in 1948 there were Hindu-Muslim riots when partition was enacted. And sometimes many people were killed in these riots. They were left dead and lying in the street. The municipal authorities came and swept up all the dead bodies the next day. They didn't know who was Muslim and who was Hindu. That was the gist of the conflict. The Hindus were fighting against the Muslims. But once they were dead, it was impossible to tell who was a Muslim and who was a Hindu. So that was another argument for saying that I'm not this body. Anyway, it was Yudhisthira Maharaj who said that it was kind of silly of him to think that he would that he was responsible for all these deaths to just instate him on the throne. He said it was kind of silly because the bodies don't actually belong to us. And he used these examples. I don't know if he used them. These are examples that were used somewhere along the way, that bodies belong to parents. They belong to employers and slaveholders. They belong to dogs and jackals and worms and so on. And later on in the Bhagavatam, I think this is in chapter 9 of the first canto, Yudhisthira goes to Bhishma. Bhishma is passing away. He's been involved in the battle of Kurukshetra, and he's on this bed of arrows. And at one point, when he was lying on this bed of arrows, and also he was still alive because he was given the benediction that he could only die when he wanted to die. This was given to him by his father, Maharaj Santanu, when he took the vow of celibacy, when Bhishma took the vow of eternal celibacy. This is sometimes called Deva Vrata. Vrata means vow, and I think it means the supreme vow, that he would become celibate. There's a long story behind why this happened, but that happened. Anyway, he was lying on this bed of arrows, and while he was lying on this bed of arrows, because he was very elderly and very senior, he was speaking very very important thoughts, very important pearls of wisdom. And one of the things he noticed when he was on this bed of arrows was that one of the people who had come to hear him was Draupadi. And she said, she was kind of smiling in an ironic way. And he said, how can you be smiling at a time like this? Everyone seems to be very grave, and I'm very grave. So she said, when I was being disrobed by the Kurus, when they were attempting to disrobe me, you sat there and you didn't do anything. And now, everyone is listening to you speak Dharma. How is that possible? And so he said that I didn't say anything. And this is explained in some of Prabhupada's lectures, I think in the Bhagavatam, that he was in the care of Duryodhana. Duryodhana was maintaining him. He was feeding him. He was taking care of him. He was looking after him in so many ways. So he said he couldn't do anything. But now, all the blood is being drained out of my body because I've been hit by so many arrows. And all the prasada that was given to me by Duryodhana company was transformed into blood, and it's drained out of me. And so now, I've become purified of that contamination, we might say, and I can speak Dharma. So anyway, Yudhisthira, this is getting off the subject a little bit, Yudhisthira went to him because Bhishma was considered the grandfather of the Pandavas. And he was very, very upset and very bewildered over the fact that so many people had died just to put him on the throne. And so he wanted to hear what Bhishma had to say about this, if this was really, if he was incurring sin, if he was doing something wrong or whatever. And it's significant that he went to Bhishma, because Bhishma is one of the Mahajans, he's one of the 12 Mahajans, Svayamvara, not a dope, Bhishma. And he was very disturbed in his mind, and he did what devotees should do, is he went to an authority, and someone who was, he considered, wiser and superior to him to get some wisdom, to learn what to do. And then the rest, he was kind of absolved from his feeling of having sinned. The reason was that he acted upon Krishna's behalf. Krishna wanted this war, and we read that Krishna tried to avert this difficult war, tried to make peace with the other side, but they were intent, the Duryodhana and company were very intent, and Dhritarashtra was very intent upon making this war. It was a very difficult thing, but because he was acting under Krishna's advice, he was free from sin. This is a criticism that's sometimes leveled at devotees. How could a war be fought? In fact, before I was a devotee, I was reading a translation of Bhagavad Gita. Of course, it wasn't Prabhupada's. And it was very bewildering to me how, after all this very high spiritual discussion went on, how there was a big war that was fought at the end of it. And this is a very bewildering thing for many people to understand. People have even said to me, I thought all Christians were nonviolent. And when I was in San Francisco, this was in about 1968 or 67, one of the ballroom owners that we were trying to preach in or to have some kirtan in said, what would you do if someone hit you in the face? And the answer was, I was with another devotee who said, well, we hit him back. And he liked that. He thought that was very good, because many people, like him, thought that Krishna's always were nonviolent. And one example Prabhupada gave once was about Gandhi. And he said that Gandhi was preaching nonviolence. And that the rulers of India, who were then the British, were accommodating that. They were, as Prabhupada's word, patting him, sort of like patting him on the back. They could go along with it. But it was Netaji Bose. What was his first name? Not Subhash Chandra Bose. Was it? Yeah, somebody Bose, who created the Indian National Army and showed and got the Gurkhas back from Germany to join him, and had a real show of force. They were ready to fight with the British, and it was at that point that the British pulled out of India, created partition, unfortunately, and India became independent. That was in 1947 or 1948. So devotees can be violent, and Arjuna had to be violent, Yudhisthira and the Pandavas had to be violent because Krishna ordered it. Therefore, it was not sinful. Sometimes devotees are criticized for this too, for being non-violent, or for being violent when they should be non-violent. But actually, according to the way Bose behaved and Arjuna and Yudhisthira behaved, violence is part of Krishna consciousness if it's enacted under Krishna. It's not that one is unnecessarily violent. Generally, devotees are very peaceful and very concerned about even stepping on ants and breathing in microbes and killing them. And Prabhupada writes this in Bhagavad Gita. It's written that every time one cooks, draws water, and breathes and walks, there's killing involved. You're stepping on ants, you're breathing in microbes. You're always cooking, and they used to, in India, crush with mortar and pestle all the spices instead of, you know, buying already crushed spices, and that meant killing small creatures. So cooking, drawing water, walking, and breathing are always involving killing. So we're not really nonviolent. It's just that all the so-called violence that we commit is absolved, is rectified, and is dismissed because of chanting Hare Krishna. There's one passage that says that chanting once Hare Krishna, I think Rupa Goswami may have written this, absolves one of more sins than one can commit. So chanting is very powerful and enables us to overcome all sinful activities. And as Krishna writes in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sarvadharman, that if we actually become Krishna conscious, we can overcome all sinful activities. It's possible. And that can be made possible during the age of Kali by chanting Hare Krishna. Chanting Hare Krishna is available at all times, but it's especially recommended in this age of Kali. Kali Ardosha Nihed Rajan. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam that says that the age of Kali is full of faults, but
There is one good quality, and that good quality is chanting Hare Krishna. Other scriptures say that Krishna is actually present here in the form of his name. It's not that chanting is some sentimental song. It's actually realizing Krishna. So I'm going to stop here and ask if there's anything to add or any questions or points of controversy that need to be discussed. Yes.
What do we do as a society, separate from the host society? We're running our society, and someone needs chastising. Are we able to use violence?
Can you say that again, please? I'll try to repeat.
We imagine when we set up our own society, separate from the host society,
mm-hmm.
will we be using violence to chastise miscreants?
So the question is, when Krishna, let's see if I'm right, Krishna consciousness becomes very influential and powerful, can it use force to straighten out the miscreants? Is that basically what you're saying?
Within our own society.
Within our own society. Well, to a certain extent, I don't know if I understand how it would work, if I understand your question right, but administering within our own society sometimes requires violence. Sometimes administering within our own society requires a form of violence.
Yeah.
For example, well, this is not an example, but this is kind of figurative. Sometimes round pegs have to be put into square holes and square pegs have to be put into round holes. And this can be very unpleasant for some people. And one person in a GBC meeting said that in future, all members of the GBC would be managers as apart from gurus and sannyasis, because gurus and sannyasis, he said, have to be very kind to everyone. Whereas someone who's a manager or administrator cannot be kind to everyone. I understood somewhere that Duryodhana, although he was a very materialistic person, was a very good administrator. But other things that I've read said that the Pandavas, who were Raja Rishis, who were very compassionate, would be even better, because they would consider the welfare of everyone. So this supposes a very difficult dilemma and a difficult question. How is it possible to be kind to everyone at the same time to be a good administrator? But this is one of the things that the Pandavas had to do. They had to be good administrators and very kind to everyone. It's mentioned, I think, in one of the lectures about Yudhisthira, that he was very concerned when all this killing went on, that there were many women that were left childless, husbandless, fatherless, and brotherless. And he was very concerned about these. And this is a verse, actually, in the Bhagavatam, in the 8th chapter. He mentions the word stri, meaning ladies or women. So he was very concerned. And this is another criticism that's sometimes leveled at ISKCON, is that the women are not protected or taken care of. And yet here was a Rajarishi, Yudhisthira, who was very concerned that because of this war, so many people would be bereft of protection. He was very concerned about that. But in answer to your question, it seems that some form of, I don't know if violence is the right word, but some forms of discontent would be necessary in administering a society, even if it became, as it became, especially as it became larger and more influential. I don't know if that helps. Anything else? Yes?
Guruji, you mentioned the ballroom manager asking the question.
The
ballroom manager asked the question.
The ballroom manager,
somebody,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Somebody came up and hit you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the reply of we would hit them back. I was under the impression that we should turn the other cheek. If somebody causes some that sort of violence on ourselves, maybe
if they give it to another devotee, then another devotee might respond. But our own self,
I didn't think that that was something that we would retaliate to.
Well, I think the question was if someone strikes you, what would you do? And the way the question was asked, it was just anyone, and anyone meant to the person who replied, but it wasn't going to be someone in the society, but just any person walking on the street. If it hits you, what would you do? And although Jesus Christ said we should turn the other cheek and be nonviolent, the response, which was given by a devotee, said that, well, if someone hit me, I would hit him back. And it's not necessarily a standard answer for everything in every case, but for this particular case, and in this for this particular person, it was the right answer, because he wanted to see if we were always nonviolent. And he liked the fact that we would defend ourselves. And I think that's even a law, that you can defend yourself, and even if it involves killing someone, that if you're doing it in self-defense, then it's okay. I don't know if that's a good answer. If that addresses
it's a good answer, very much,
question.
But it's just different to what I thought that if there was something against our own self, we should be humble and take that as Krishna's arrangement. But okay to defend another devotee and to defend Krishna, but not ourselves.
Yeah, well then Molly was asking if we could be violent to defend someone else, but not necessarily to defend ourselves. And I think that's for the most part, that's the case. Within the society of devotees, as far as I know, if there's some kind of violent or disagreeable thing that occurs, that instead of retaliating in kind, that one should say, well, what's the problem? Let's discuss this and then try to work it out so that this feeling doesn't exist. That would be the more proper way within a devotee society to do it. But it might start out with some fisticuffs in the beginning. It's kind of inevitable.
I just remember that, like, I think if someone steals your wife or burns your house or kisses you, you can kill them.
Yeah, that's written in the Bhagavad Gita, that there are six different kinds of aggressors. And therefore, violence is sanctioned under certain conditions, definitely. And those are like burning the house, stealing property, violating the wife, and so on. There's six different kinds of aggressors.
I just wonder, Maharaj, because sometimes devotees use that verse to kill mosquitoes, said, "They're piercing me, so I can kill them."
That the thing about mosquitoes came up once with Sridhar Kirti, who was a Prabhupada servant for a long time, and he, when he was massaging Prabhupada, he was sometimes slapping and killing mosquitoes. He became a little bit bewildered about this, and once he asked Prabhupada, he said, "Is it okay to kill mosquitoes?" And there was a bit of a silence, and then Prabhupada responded by saying, "You can kill them if they're attacking." And that's one of the ways that one can be aggressive, according to the Bhagavad Gita. One attacks with weapons. Yes?
Just going on from what ladies were saying about striking back, what I understand from it, correct me if it's wrong, is that if someone does strike you, then I suppose I have the right to strike them back, but maybe I could try to see if I can just incur and say, I'll see what happens if I don't strike them back. With that, that helps the situation. If they keep striking me, then I might strike them back.
Yeah, sometimes people get in prolonged fist fights. And like I said, it might be necessary to hit back first, but then to discuss the matter, rather than it just ending up into a big, long, drawn-out fight. On the other hand, if sometimes it's necessary. There's a case where Maharaj Pariksit saw an animal being tortured, and so he was prepared to kill a person who was doing this because the animal couldn't defend itself. So there's that too. But for the most part, devotees are nonviolent. Like Christ said, to turn the other cheek. And if within the society of devotees there's some kind of violent behavior, it should be determined what's causing it, rather than just ending you know, having a sort of draw, indeterminate fist fight. Yeah.
Regarding the same case about hitting back, was that kind of Desha Kalapatra in this case?
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. I think what Vladimir was saying that it's a desha kalapatra situation. Like, it's not always the same. Sometimes it's necessary to fight. Sometimes it's necessary to turn the other cheek. And it depends on who's involved and what the circumstances are. Sometimes it's just absolutely necessary.
I mean, to answer that gentleman, to answer that way, I'll hit back.
Well, yeah, again, that particular person, when I was talking about the ballroom owner, he's kind of a violent person, so he liked a kind of violent answer, but it's not necessarily the right answer all the time for all people. Yes?
I imagine this is probably just a little bit controversial, but did Prabhupada ever say that we should follow the laws of the country above the Vedic laws, like Vilas mentioned about those incidents where it's allowable in the Vedas to, to retaliate.
And she raised the question about whether the laws of a particular country need to be obeyed, even if they're in conflict with Vedic laws. That's a very interesting point, and I don't want to prolong this because it could we go on and on. It's kind of a sociological type of issue. But one thing that happened was that there was a devotee that was promoting polygamy at one point. You know, polygamy is like a man can have any number of wives. And at first Prabhupada kind of didn't really say very much because in Vedic times it's okay to do that, but it's against the law in the United States where this thing came up. It's probably against the law in this country too, isn't it? Polygamy. And then Prabhupada wrote a very kind of definitive letter. It was in writing, it wasn't just spoken, but it was in writing. That means it's more definitive, that polygamy would not be allowed within ISKCON. And part of the reason, well, that's just a law of that country. So, and then there's a passage in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that says that one who I don't know, I can't quote it exactly, but the idea is that disobeying the government is sinful. And this is a very, very difficult thing to understand sometimes because about 500 years ago, India was under the rule of the Pathans, the Muslims. And they operated their rule under Muslim rule, which often was very different from Vedic law. Nonetheless, Lord Chaitanya and his followers lived under that regime. And for the most part, as far as I understand, even Sanatana Rupa were part of that regime. So that's an indication that the laws of the land, even though there may be some conflict, are to be obeyed. And I'm very careful when I'm driving my car to obey all the traffic laws. Once when I was in England, I did something that was a little bit, not exactly illegal, but it was kind of in a gray area. And the person driving the other car, who was kind of inconvenienced by my driving, had only about one second to say something to me out the window of his car. And he said, "You're a disgrace to your religion." He has obviously had a shaved head. So I think it's 10 minutes past time to end. So I'm going to stop here. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.